Blog Talk Radio.
Life is a song worth singing. Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand. Use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it?
Welcome, welcome to another very exciting show of Solar Now and the Future with this economic impact on Black America. And with your host, yours truly, Ronald Buffet, we're broadcasting live from your nation's capital on via Blog Talk Radio format. And we are also streaming over Facebook and Twitter. And the slogan for our show, if there's power in numbers, then the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative captures that power for your financial benefit. Well, today's date, July 12th, 2017, and we have, as I indicated, another very exciting show for audience. And you can join us by calling in at 646-668-2948. Once again, that call-in number is 664-668-2948. And please remember, after you call the number, please press 1 on your phone pad because you will be in queue mode and we want to be able to bring you into our studio, into the green room, so we can share with the other listeners your comments and suggestions on this great radio format. As many of you may be aware, last week we did what we call measuring the impact of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And we look back over the first 10 months and broadcasts that we've done. And we sort of tried to bring that home with a synopsis of some of the key issues that we've covered. But today's show, we have a very, very exciting guest, a young man by the name of Mr. John Farrell, who is Director of Energy Democracy with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. The Institute mission is to provide an incentive. The Institute's mission is to provide an initiative strategies, working model, and timely information to support environmental, sound, and equitable community development. To this end, ILRS works with citizens, activists, policymakers and entrepreneurs to design systems, policies, and enterprises that meet local and regional needs to maximize human, material, natural, and financial resources, and to assure that the benefits of these systems and resources occur for all local citizens. Now, a little of the bio, our guest, which will be joining us in very shortly. Mr. John Farrell is the director for the Energy for Democracy, an initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and widely known as the guru of distributed energy. John is best known for his valid illustrations of economic and environmental benefits of local ownership and the decentralization of renewable energy. He is the author of the Energy Self-Reliant States, a state-by-state atlas of renewable energy potential, highlighted in the New York Times, showing that most states don't need to look outside of their borders to meet their electricity needs. He's also written extensively on the economic advantages of democratizing electricity system, published in a rich interactive map on the solar grid priority, and published policies like the Minnesota Solar Energy Standards, necessary to support local-owned energy development. John provides data-rich presentations on local renewable energy for common citizens and has wowed crowds from the Maine to San Francisco. He's been a keynote speaker at conferences like the Solar Energy Focus in Washington, D.C., and also inspired citizens in Boulder, Colorado, prior to their successful effort to seize more control over their energy future. John works and appears mostly regularly on Energy Self-Reliant States, a blog radio show that timely and compelling analysis of current energy discussion and policy. The posts are frequently enriched by his chats, translating the complex economics of energy into tools and advancing local energy ownership, and have been regularly syndicated at Clean Tech and Renewable Energy. And that is the background information on our guest that will be joining us very, very shortly. I wanted to sort of get his bio on out there to our listening audience so we would have that covered. Now, for those who are familiar with this program, and for those who are not, you can join us by logging on to our website at www.positivechangepc.com. That's www.positivechangepc.com. And please click on our News and Events tab. I'm going to just give you a little rundown of some of the posts that we recently posted for the education of our followers at the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative. Congress unnerved by energy grid hack. This was done by Mr. Jeremy Dillon. It was published on July 10th. Senator Marcia Cantwell, a Democrat from Washington State, has been concerned about the energy grid's vulnerabilities for some time and has been warning the administration against budget cuts to cyberspace security agencies. And I think that's a very, very interesting read. Reminder, the fight for 100% renewable is political, by John Farrell, who will be joining us very, very shortly. That is a June 28, 2017 article. As an increasing number of citizens across the U.S. pledged their commitment to purchase 100% of their power from renewable sources in the coming decade, some researchers question the feasibility of such energy policies. Amid EV surge, Austin eyes, Texas eyes, a new way of doing business. The District of Columbia regulators seek to enhance retail energy customer protections. This was done by Robert Walton, published on July 10th. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and we'll be joined very, very shortly by our guest, who will be coming into the studios in another maybe 6 or 7 minutes. We scheduled him at a quarter after the top of the hour. So we want to continue to sort of give you a list of things that you'll be able to find at our website at positivechangepc.com. Please click on the News and Events tab, and you'll be able to follow us. Energy and Environment. Volvo betting on electric vehicles moves to phase out conventional engines. This is an article that appeared in the New York Times by Jack Ewing, July 5th, 2017. Very, very interesting read there. Clean Energy States Alliance, SEIA, okay, is a national nonprofit coalition of public agencies and organizations working to advance clean energy. SEIA members, mostly state agencies, include members of the most innovative, successful, influential public funders of clean energy. And we will have them on our show in the coming week to come. Welcome to Green Technical Education and Employment, which is a charter school headed by Mr. Simeon Gant out of San Clemente, California. And I strongly, strongly suggest that you go to our website and you click on our video gallery on the video that we have embedded in on the front page of our website and listen to the very, very, very intelligent young African-American students and students of color that Mr. Simeon Gant works with at the Green Technology Educational and Employment Institute out in Sacramento, California. Home builders embrace net zero with new building program. African-American-owned D.C.-based Volt Energy installed solar at the Wake Forest University. That's Mr. Gilbert Campbell's company, who is one of the CEO and founding partners of Volt Energy, and they do a very, very dynamic job, and that's another very, very interesting read. Also, Verizon Center in Washington, D.C. will be powered by solar energy. Trending, this is a June 14, 2014 article, and it was done by Mr. Ivory Latta. And very, very interesting read. Also, we have Zotech News, which is Mr. Ringo's company, very, very interesting read. Powering America, not for profit, consumer owned electric cars provide service to 42 million people in 47 states. And I strongly suggest that our listening audience take a look at that particular article. As you can hear, we have a new number of very, very interesting articles appear in our news, online news and events magazine at positivechangepc.com. And once again, this show is brought to you by the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative. And if anyone wants to know what we do and what we're about, please go to our website at www.positivechangepc.com, and you can click on About Us, and it will give you our project rationale. And I think it's a very, very informative layout that we put there, which brings it very, very close to home, which our goals are to be able to work with our historically black colleges and universities through public-private partnerships, as well as to increase the market share for African-American-owned solar installation companies, which out of 9,929 companies, based on the data put out by the Solar Foundation, there are only 9 African-American companies that are doing business here in the continental U.S. based on the data that we've been able to gather and, as we say, verify. So once again, welcome to the airways of Solar Now and the Future. Now, after our guest, John Farwell, who will be joining us very, very shortly, we will be looking at the article that appeared in the New York Times by Jack Hewing, July 5th, 2017. Volvo plug-in hybrids at the auto show in Peking 2014. And it talks about Volvo cars on Wednesday became the first mainstream automaker to sound the death knell for internal combustion engines, saying that all the models introduced starting in 2019 will either be hybrids or powered by solar battery engines. The bold decision is the boldest commitment by any major car company to technologies that currently represent a small share of the total vehicle market, but are increasingly viewed as essential to combating climate change and urban pollution. We are just being joined by our guest. Good morning, Mr. Farwell.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yes, I'm very, very pleased to have you on the airways of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. I've already done a bio reading for you, so I won't have to reintroduce you to our listening audience. But would you sort of listening audience, who John Farwell is and what do you do with the Institute for Self-Reliance?
Yeah, happy to do that. I have always liked the moniker that David Roberts, who writes for Vox, gave me, which is the guru of distributed energy. But the way I also like to talk about our work is with this phrase, energy democracy. I direct our energy democracy program, which is focused on helping people and communities take charge of their energy future, to be able to decide where their energy comes from and decide who owns it, and to decide what the energy system in their community should look like. And so we do that through helping lots of grassroots organizations and elected officials, and doing kind of boring old policy analysis to decide which policies we think are most effective in helping communities seize that future.
Well, I think, and I don't think, I know that the Institute for Local and Self-Reliance, as we say, if it was ever needed, your organization is needed now with the administration of 45. I will use that term because we don't care to mention the 45th president's name on the airways of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. Looking at the fact that President Obama's administration, the largest thing that his administration accomplished was not the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, but it was the Sunshine Identity Initiative, where President Obama's administration was able to get through Congress $30 billion in what we call federal loan guarantees to build large-scale solar utility farms. But one of the very, very disturbing things about this as it relates to our show, which is called Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America, is when Van Jones in 2007, who authored the Green Jobs Act, was able to get that signed into law only after a very, very embarrassing situation with W. Walker Bush administration as how they handled the Katrina flood in New Orleans, he signed into law the Green Jobs Act. From that, in 2008, that act resulted in $500 million in workforce development training. And it's been very, very puzzling to me why, since we've been doing this show for about 10 months now, I have reached out to organizations such as SEIA, which is, you know, is the Solar Energy Industry Association. We've reached out to the Solar Foundation, and we've asked these organizations, what happened to the $10 million in workforce development training? Only about a week ago, several weeks ago, we had the opportunity to have Mr. Sean O'Brien from the North American Board of Energy Practitioners that handles the certification for workforce development training. And if you are certified in the U.S., that certification comes through their organizations. Now, one of the points that I like to bring home and make it very, very plain, in 2009, the American Association of Blacks in Energy, put out a report that indicated that African Americans spent $41 billion in energy in the U.S., but we only had 1.1% of the jobs and only received 0.8% of the wealth from the industry. Fast forward 2015, the Solar Foundation puts out another a report that indicated that the industry in 2015 employed approximately 260,000 people. It was 23.8% women, 11.3% Hispanics, 8.3% Pacific Islanders and Asians, and veterans, but the African American community, we bring up the bottom of the barrel at 6.6%. So it was very fuzzy to me and troubling to me because we are both male and female, and we also joined the military. So not beating a dead horse, I'd like to know, have your organization have an opportunity to be able to sort of look at some of the policies as it relates to when you say communities controlling the wealth, what and how have you been able to engage communities of color around this country with the work that your organization does?
That's a great question. And what I would say is that we haven't done enough, but there are a couple of very promising things that we've been working on that I think will help. One of those is around what is called shared renewables or shared solar or community solar. And the idea is that for folks who either don't have a sunny rooftop or don't have enough money to buy a solar array for their own rooftop or who live in a rental property and don't own their own roof, what method do they have to own a share of a solar array? And these community solar policies let people buy solar panels. You know, maybe it's on a nearby church, maybe it's in a farm field in the next county, but allow them to buy solar as well as somebody who owns their own home and has a sunny rooftop and to get that energy benefit on their bill. That's one key piece of allowing, you know, opening the door. But the second piece, and I think even the more important piece, is figuring out how will people pay for that? Because as we know, and there's a long history of this, of inequity in wealth between people of color and white folks, that we need to have financing policies. We need to have ways that people can buy into this that are accessible to everybody. And what we have seen is a policy that we call inclusive financing. We have a report about it on our website. Some other folks call it tariff-based financing, which is terribly into the wonky language. But the point of it is essentially that the utility can put up the money or through the utility, a bank can put up the money to allow people to buy into these community solar projects without having to take out a loan on their own credit. And then pay it back on their utility bill, which is where they're going to see the benefits. And it's policies like these that have been used by a number of electric cooperatives in the Southeast, for example, to allow people to either do solar or to do insulation in their homes and weatherization very successfully for folks who normally wouldn't have had the money in order to do those kinds of investments. So I think that's one of the very promising things that we've been working on that is accessible to everybody, but really targets folks who have been previously left out of the energy economy.
Well, John, I really appreciate the work that you do and y'all do at the Institute for Local and Self-Reliance. We have been blessed here in the DMV market area, Washington, D.C. market area, in Maryland and Virginia area, because I know you have had the opportunity of interviewing Mrs. Anna Schulman with the Community Empowerment Network. Her organization does an outstanding job with working in the communities and trying to educate the different communities on how to do solar bulk buys and how to go about the process of selecting an installer. But one of the things that's been very, very troubling to me is that when I had a Dr. Vito Felito with Snipes organization, they're an organization out of Cambridge, Mass., and they did a study here in Washington, D.C., which was done for the People's Council, and they talked about the the lack of facility of solar panels, PV systems in the District of Columbia here in the nation's capital. Now, you fast forward and you look at the fact that we had an opportunity to have the chair of the Public Service Commission, Mrs. Betty Ann Keynes, a very dynamic lady here, and she came on this show several months, it hadn't been 2 months ago, and she talked about the Renewable Energy Development Fund. Now, this particular development fund comes from the ratepayers. It's put on, it's a fee that's attached to the each Pepco, which is the major supplier of electricity in the district, bill. Now, because Washington, D.C., legislatively, the council has chosen to make Washington a renewable portfolio standard, some of the highest in the country, and the value of a what we call solar energy credit is with the new legislation that Mayor Bowser here signed here in the nation's capital is $500 per credit. And because there is a lack of suppliers for Pepco to purchase these certs from, it's a vicious cycle where the D.C. City Council has a reprogram based on an audit report that the Public Service Commission did here in Washington, D.C. They've moved about $45 million from this fund over the last 5 years since its inception. And they recently took a vote and they moved $7.5 million. Well, I had Mrs. Anna Schulman on the show. I had the director of the Department of Energy and Environment, Mr. Tommy Wells, here in Washington, D.C., on the airways of this show, Solar Now in the Future, with his economic impact on Black America, talking about the impact that this would have on initiatives for funding to assist low and moderate income communities get these PV systems installed on their homes as well as businesses here in the district. So that's all. As you have written a very, very outstanding article that so all these issues are political. Could you share with our listening audience a little bit about this the article you just published?
Yeah, you know, the origin of this piece was kind of a wonky debate about the technical issues in getting to a grid that is 100% renewable. And ultimately, what I would say about it is it's something that we folks who spend a lot of time behind spreadsheets looking at how you build wind and solar systems and how the grid does the balancing act of supplying electricity focus a lot on, but that has very little practical implication. The issue is that if people are talking about the challenges of getting to 100% from a technical standpoint and bringing that into the political conversation, where, you know, you've seen Sierra Club and other organizations getting a lot of cities excited about adopting a 100% goal. We don't want to undermine that, because the point here is that we need to set aspirational goals that get people excited about what we can change in our energy system, not just getting to 100%, but 100% for the 100%, which is to say that everybody should be able to have a piece of the economic rewards of this transition to renewable energy, because ultimately we're talking about energy systems that are going to be more cost effective, more than fossil fuels in the long run, that don't require fossil fuel energy, aren't, you know, volatile because of rising and falling fossil fuel prices. And so that we need to figure out, you know, how to make those broad commitments and how to put them in place and not worry too much about, you know, in 2017, how we're going to get that last 20% from 80% renewable energy to 100% renewable energy, a transition that's probably going to happen more than 20 years from now. So I think the point was that, you know, we can't get too bogged down in some of the technical details of what's feasible. Number one, because it undermines our need to organize and to push back against utility companies who are always looking for arguments as to why we can't get there. But number two, because technology is going to change tremendously. I mean, I think about, you know, the kind of phone that you had 20 years ago was probably still attached to the wall. And now we have smartphones that have all these amazing capabilities. They all use batteries, and on these batteries are going to revolutionize the way that the grid can operate, because we're going to have more capability to store and move around energy. So that's all a long way of saying that, this debate is really a political one between the incumbent powers, whether that's the fossil fuel industry that wants to supply electric utilities or electric utilities that want to preserve their market share, and that we need to focus on that debate and the fact that this transition needs to be about taking away market share from incumbent utilities and about giving that power, economic power and political power, to people who can generate their own energy.
Well, we reached out to the Honorable Sheila Jackson Lee of Houston, who is a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, and we have also reached out to a number of, because she has served on the Energy Committee, to try to deal with the issue that when you look at the 19 southern states, I had Dr. Velito from the Snipes Organization, Cambridge, Mass, because one of the things that has been one of our pet peeves here, we've been pushing and trying to work on initiatives for historically black colleges and universities, which we have approximately 103 HBCUs here in the U.S., and we only have two of those institutions that have solar farms, which is the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, UMES, and the University of the Virgin Islands, which is a member of the Virgin Islands, is one of our states, but they're not on the mainland. But when you look at the 19 southern states where you have approximately about 75% of the African-American population base where our historically black colleges and universities are located, those states don't have renewable portfolio standards. And I had the opportunity to interview a gentleman with Search Trade, Tom McKinty, to talk about what creates a search marketplace. And one of the things that he spoke about was the fact that you have to have renewable portfolio standards, you have to have net metering legislation, and you need community solar legislation to be passed. And when you look at these southern states and looking at the outstanding work you've done with the map that you put together, it clearly shows that the southern states don't have a lot of this legislation in place, and it is a direct correlation with a communities of color being able, and as well as the growth of African-American-owned solar installations companies being able to flourish and create job opportunities in those markets. Because if you don't have this type of legislation in place, it's impossible for a company to come in or a developer to come in and use a power purchase agreement to try to build these large-scale utility farms, which are desperately needed at historically black colleges and universities to offset their higher energy costs. So have your organization looked at that area, aspect of public policy?
Yeah, we're absolutely focused on that. You mentioned the map. We call it the Community Power Map, and the idea behind it was rather than just showing what states had what kinds of renewable energy policies, it was in part to point out which states have policies that enable more local and community action. So in particular, a focus on policies like community solar, but also including things like net metering or carve-outs for solar energy. And as you mentioned, you know, there's a lot less activity in some of those historically more populous African-American states. And so what we see as being, I see a couple of things here. One is, you know, it gets back to that issue of this being political, which is, you know, the big utilities in some of these states like Duke Energy or Florida Power and Light have enormous political power, tons of lobbyists. They throw lots of money into ballot initiatives to push back and to try to avoid the passage of laws that threaten their market share. And the good news is they don't always win. Florida Power and Light spent tens of millions of dollars against a ballot initiative to preserve solar rights in Florida, and they lost. There's a bill moving through the Georgia legislature to enable third-party ownership or to enable these power purchase agreements that colleges could do to do solar that's being co-sponsored by Republican legislators who are interested in competition for these utilities that haven't had any competition. And North Carolina, I think, stands out as an interesting example because what they've done is that they've properly implemented it's actually a 1978 federal law called PURPA. I won't get into the acronym too much, but that required utilities to buy power from third parties. It was kind of the first law of utility competition. And thousands of megawatts of solar have been developed in North Carolina under that law because it required utilities to publish what the fair price for solar was and for solar companies to be able to get a fair contract. And so there are all sorts of things like that. Some of it gets very wonky, but the key is that, you know, we can and we should seize on a few of these policies that open up the market to more competition, that require utilities to compete against these energy sources, and that give, whether it's a college or a university or individuals or a group of individuals and neighbors, the power to make their own energy decisions.
Well, I champion what you're saying because when I recently had Mr. Ahmet Rodin, who is the director for the Public Policy Institute for at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C., and he indicated that American University and George Washington University Hospital and George Washington University entered into a PPA agreement with Duke Energy several years back. What is very, very troubling to me is that the presidents of our historic and black colleges, having the first African-American president who had an opportunity to serve two terms, and his administration sort of put the solar and renewable energy industry on steroids with the initiatives that he was able to put forth, did not move in a timely manner to get some of these initiatives started at our HBCUs. Matter of fact, I traveled to the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and met with the director, the dean of the School of Engineering, Dr. Dunn at UMES, being that they was the first HBCU to build a 17-acre solar farm, which is saving them about 15% of their energy bill, which is substantial for a small HBCU. And he indicated that they did not have a workforce development training program, and we pushed forward and pushed forward. We contacted the United Negro College Fund as well as the National Association for Equal Opportunity in Higher Education, which is ran by Mr. Dr. Neil Lomax and Mrs. Leslie Baskerville. And we tried to get them to get this jump started. So fortunately enough, on January 17, 2017, 7 of the institutions signed a MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, with the Department of Energy and Environment. Unfortunately, we had someone called 45 to come to power, who in fact put a gag order on the DOE, put Rex Tillerson, who was a former governor of Texas, brought in Scott Pruitt from Oklahoma, head EPA, put a gag order on both agencies, which I found out from a very, very reliable source on yesterday, that the gag order still exists. So that initiative and that MOU, nobody knows what has happened to it. I've spoke with Mr. Ron Butler, who's head of the HBCU consortium out of Miami, who spearheaded this effort with these HBCUs, and nobody seems to know what's going on with this right now. So I don't know where that will go, because I do understand that the Department of Energy budget has been targeted to take a 40% hit with EPA, which is very disturbing to me, because I know that former head of the Program for Diversity, Dr. Dot Harris, did an outstanding job at the Department of Energy putting forth some initiatives to work with communities of color with STEM and educational programs across this country. So I would hope that this might be something that the Institute for Local Self-Reliance might look into in the future, because we need all the allies that we can get as it relates to this solar and renewable energy industry, because we also have hydrogenetics, we have wind turbine, and I spoke with the National Association of Black Farmers. You don't have one African-American farm in this country with that solar farm on a black-owned farmland. These are things that our organization, we are a purchasing cooperative ourselves. And that's one of our primary missions, is try to increase market share for African-American solar installation companies, as well to advocate for the growth of public-private partnerships to develop more utility-scale solar farms on historically black colleges and black farmlands across this country. So I would hope that this might be something that your organization might be able to support us on in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think one of the places that, you know, we don't do a lot of federal work, as you might suspect from our name about local self-reliance. We focus mostly on states and the way that states impact local communities. But I think there's an opportunity here, and you're seeing it in a few different places where we're getting close to what you're talking about. In Massachusetts, for example, they have just revised their solar incentive program, and they are giving additional incentives to solar and community solar projects that serve low-income communities. And I know that that's not necessarily an overlap with communities of color, but it would be interesting to figure out how those kinds of things could be incorporated. We see when Ontario did the same thing a number of years ago in Canada, they did have a specific call out, for example, for First Nations or their Native American communities. You also see in California, there's a set aside for the dollars from their cap and trade program for climate change for traditionally disadvantaged communities, ones that have tended to host a lot of polluting fossil fuel energy resources and that tend to be have many more people of color than the average community. So there are definitely ways that we can go about this. And I think there's definitely a need to do that. And it, you know, goes back decades in the way that we have often with deliberate public policy shortchanged people of color and in terms of wealth building opportunities. And I think there's an obligation here with the way that we look at renewable energy policy to see how we can change that. And things like inclusive financing that I mentioned earlier that break down those barriers in terms of both wealth and access to credit, I think are crucial tools.
Well, one of the things that I think is very, very crucial and very, very important is the educational component around the issue of solar and renewable energy as it relates to communities of color, and specifically the African-American community. I know that I had a brief conversation with a member of the D.C. State Board of Education about this new educational format that they are putting forth to around environment for the D.C. public school system. And I had a brief discussion this morning with Mr. Hayworth with the D.C. State Board of Education. And this is very concerning to me because I look at the struggle of Mr. Simeon Gant. Mr. Gant heads a private Green Tech charter school based in Sacramento, California. And he's doing some outstanding work with what he does with his organization in working with educating our young African-American students there in that community around the issue of PV installation as well as other areas as energy advisors. And there are there are a number of things that they're doing with their that charter school there, and I think it needs to be replicated across this country, as well as more community engagement. This was something that I spoke with Mr. Tommy Wells about recently. Grid Alternatives, which is a national organization, just received a $950,000 grant and to train 75 D.C. residents on becoming PV installation installers, as well as to install PV systems on 100 low and moderate income residents' homes here in the District of Columbia, in the nation's capital. But one of the problems that I've had when I reached out to the solar companies themselves, such as Solar City and enormous solar companies, they seem to want to put little or nothing back into these communities, but they want to market this these PV systems in communities of color. And I know I've also reached out for even advertising support for this format that we have, because our goal is to move this show to the airways of our NPR stations, because we have 106, as I said, HBCUs, but most of them have radio stations, but they're all NPR stations. That mean they're non-commercial stations. So I have to bring to the table the dollars to underwrite this show to be able to get your interview, which I think is very, very important, heard through to the airways of our young African-American listeners. Because when you're talking about an industry, the electricity industry, just based on some information that was put out by the rural cooperatives, they indicated that the electricity industry in continental U.S. just last year, 2016, generated $364 billion. And people can go to our website at positivechangepc.com, click on our news and events tab, and you can scroll down and read that very informative article for yourself. You'll also find the information on the Institute for Local Self-Reliance there that we've also posted. So we want people to understand that this industry, the solar and renewable industry, did $200 billion out of that $364 billion. And the solar and renewable industry, a renewable industry on the solar aspect, did approximately worldwide $1.4 trillion. And that's not taking into account looking at wind turbine or hydrogenetics, because it is very, very important that our people understand the relationships between technology shifts. I think George Siva has done an outstanding job in a video that he's put together called The Great Disruption, Transportation and Energy. And I know that your organization, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, have looked at some of these coming technologies and impacts that they're going to have on the local marketplace, such as electric vehicles. And as we look at the issue of putting the charging station infrastructure, there are tons of business opportunities there that aren't even being talked about, specifically in the African American community. And maybe this is something that you might talk about on some of the shows that you do, because you do an outstanding job with a blog show that you host.
Yeah. You know, I also think, too, you know, one example of where I think we can do some of this work, we've been involved in what's called the Clean Energy Partnership in the city of Minneapolis. It was formed 4 years ago as a partnership between the city and the electric utility and the gas utility around the city's climate action goals. But they also include a lot of really substantial goals around reducing the energy burden to be equitable across both race and class. And one of the things that's been done is the group that is this partnership organization has been mapping out where energy services have been delivered around the city historically and identifying the priority communities where we need to take action and that are disproportionately, people of color. And I think that even just having that map together as we propose where funding should go for this partnership and where energy services should be delivered has been really helpful in identifying, where the priorities should be. And it makes me think as well, you know, when you talk about both education and getting people more aware of whether it's solar or these other technologies, is to what extent can we do demonstration projects, you know, get solar on all of the schools that serve any student, frankly, so that they can, you know, get a chance to understand, like, hey, solar energy is something that can happen in my community. And now I should start asking about how it can go in other buildings in my community, whether that's a community center or a park building or a church or my own home. And so I think there's, you know, two pieces to that. One is how do we install solar and get it out in the community as an education tool? But then also how do we guide the places where we do have resources? How do you guide this renewable development fund, for example, assuming that it's not rated by the DC City Council, to make sure that the investments are being made in the right places?
Well, one of the things that I'm looking at, I'm looking at a recent article that just appeared on July 5th. It was done by Jack Hewing. Volvo Cars on Wednesday became the first mainstream automaker to sound the death knell to the internal combustion engine, saying all of the models it will introduce starting in 2019 will be either hybrids or powered by solar batteries. So when I look at the role that Tesla is playing in terms of the Gigabyte factory, that's the largest manufacturing factory in the world that's just been built, and I had the privilege of hearing the CEO of BMW, which Volvo is one of their brands. He indicated that Tesla was not the largest builder of electric vehicles that BMW was, but they had targeted their initial models was for a six-figure income market niche, and that they were coming out with a $35,000 price vehicle, and that would be targeted to low and moderate income consumers. Is here. I mean, this is what Mr. George Siegel talks about in his online video, The Great Energy Disturbance, when he's talking about the pricing figures. And as Charlie Rose asked the CEO of BMW, well, what's the biggest problem with getting these electric vehicles in the marketplace? He said it was the charging station infrastructure. So I know that if you are able to put together the financing to build a substantial size solar utility farm, you will be in a position to try to get some contracts to power some of these charging stations, because they're going to have to be from Miami to Maine, because you got I-95, I-85, I-70, and when we begin to look at the East Coast, which is deregulated, there is when you get past North Carolina, you're going to find that there'll be so more so many opportunities in this renewable energy industry is almost mind-boggling, because you can almost they're talking about third world nations when you look at the position of the African American community and their imprint in this industry. We might as well be in Ghana or Nigeria, because we're in the same boat. And fortunately, we have a young African brother by the name of Akon, who has Akon Energy, and he's been doing some very, very dynamic things on the continent as it relates to building solar farms and bringing electricity through solar to a number of approximately 11 African nations. I think it scales out. They're supposed to, by the end of this year, bring electricity to about 80 million Africans who've never seen lights at night. And I think that that's a game changer. So I would say when it comes to solar and renewable energy, when we look at the Deep South, even though people have lights, when we get to talking about our involvement in the business sector of this industry, we're just in the same boat as our African brothers and sisters are in a third world nation here in the United States of America.
And I think there's, you know, the thing that makes me hopeful is that whether it's Tesla and starting out with a super expensive car, or solar energy, which was 10 years ago, you know, a premium product, that as we are building more and more of these things and the price is coming down, the entire industries are being disrupted and providing an opportunity to change things. So when you talk about the South, which has really been held back in renewable development by utilities that are trying to control the system, you know, one of the things that gives me hope is the fact that as batteries get cheaper because we put them in laptops and cell phones and cars, people are going to start combining them with solar at a price that's low enough that folks can just cut the cord to the utility company. And when that starts to happen, the utility company is either going to have to respond in a positive way to figure out how to accommodate these folks who would otherwise leave their service, or they're going to go bankrupt. And then we're going to have a chance to restructure the way that the utility system works and to pay attention to the needs that have not been met in the past. So I do remain very optimistic about the way that technology is changing things.
Well, John, I want to thank you for taking time from your very, very busy schedule to join us on the airways of Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America. We've got about 4 minutes left here with this episode, and your interview has been a very, very informative interview, and I want to thank you on a very, very short notice, you and Nick there at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, to come on the airways of this show. And you will not be a stranger to the airways of Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America. Do you have any closing comments? Because I know I was only able to try to schedule 30 minutes of your time, and I know I've shot past that already.
It's been no problem. It's been my pleasure. You know, what I think I would just say in closing is that there hasn't been a lot of attention to the issue of sharing the wealth, particularly in the renewable energy industry, in terms of people of color. There are a few places across the country, and California, I think, has been the best, where the grassroots organizing has been terrific and the policy is reflecting that. And I think we have a responsibility. You know, I listened to a podcast, I believe it was done by Fresh Air. It was some sort of public radio podcast a few months ago. And it goes all the way back to housing policy after the Second World War and how the GI Bill gave opportunity.
Well, John,
for returning
I don't want
back.
To cut you off, but we've got about 15 seconds here, so we're going to have to wrap it up. And
yes.
So
I really
appreciate you. Yeah, well, thank you. And because we're going to be going off the air very, very shortly here, and I didn't want to you to go off the air when you still be talking. So I wanted you.
Life is a song worth singing. I do too. Sing it. Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? You.
in the palm of your hand. Use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing.